Hey, Nora.
Hey, Sandy.
I am so looking forward to seeing you this weekend.
I know. Oh my God. It is going to be so much fun to see you and to see everybody. Oh my God. Edmonton. I hope you're ready for it.
Yeah. You know, I've never been to Edmonton.
Really?
Yeah, really, really, really. I've never been to Edmonton. I've actually really never spent time in Alberta.
No.
I mean, unless you count the Calgary airport, which I've transited through multiple times, I have not spent any time in Alberta.
Oh my God. Oh my God. That is weird, so right? Weird. Yeah. Okay. So I go to Alberta kind of a lot. Actually, this in 1 year, I'll be there four times or five times. It's actually great. It's really, really, wow. Really great place. Like, I haven't been to smaller cities in Alberta the way that I have in other provinces, but certainly, like, Calgary is great and Edmonton is awesome, and you're gonna love it. You're really, really gonna love it. My criticism of Edmonton, though, is that the river valley is too deep.
Okay.
It's just too low. Like, you can't see shit. It's just like, what's that down there? And it's like, that's the river valley. And it's like, no, I want to see a Saskatoon level river valley. I don't want to see like, that's a river valley, but just trust us on that because it's really, really low. It's really far down.
Okay. I will keep that in mind. as
you'll see what I mean.
The one criticism I have heard because of, you know, I've had cousins who've moved to either Edmonton or Calgary and friends and colleagues and so on. And everyone seems to think that it's a great place. So, you know, I'm looking forward to being there and checking it out for myself and spending time with you and the people who are the lovely listeners. And listen, if you want to see us, we will be at the Citadel Theater and you can still get tickets.
Yes, that's right. Tickets are pretty cheap, too. So go to the Citadel Theater box office. That's where you should get them. You'll be able to get tickets probably right up to the end unless they sell out. So, you know, get them earlier rather than later. And then we're going to have a little reception after. And thank you so much, Sandy. I didn't tell you this, but do you know how many karaoke bar recommendations we got after the last show?
No, really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. That's great. I'm very excited about that. I have been warming up my voice. I had a Capwood event this weekend where all I did was sing, sing, sing. And it's in good shape, Nora. It's in good shape, this voice box. And so I am ready. I'm ready for whatever duet you want to do.
Oh, my God. Okay. So that's amazing. Pressure's on, folks. We'll see. We'll see. Oh, I'm so excited. And it's just going to be lovely spring in Edmonton. And then if you're listening to this, you're like, shut up, stop talking about Edmonton. We will get other shows together, folks. So just stay tuned. You know, don't stop listening to the show so that you don't find out too late that actually we were coming to your city after all. And for the folks in Edmonton, get your tickets. We're so excited to be out there.
Yeah, so excited. So, and thank you to all of you who have already bought your tickets. And I'm sure we have other thank yous to dole out today. Let's give out some gratitude, Nora.
Yes, thank you so much to everybody who commented on the last week's episode, who shared it and who liked it and all that kind of stuff. You know, thanks just for listening too. We need you to listen for us to exist, right? Because if a podcast exists in the forest and no ears are around to hear it, or no eyes around to see the transcript, does it really make a sound? No, it does not. So thank you so much this week to everybody that changed their donation or donated for the first time. Especially thank you to John, Dave, Jules Power, Nigel, and Aaron.
Thank you so, so much. Oh my gosh. There was a big part of me that thought that this week we would either be talking about more pre-budget announcements because budget day will be on the day that we release this podcast, or that we would be talking about credit because we had like that one moment where we talked about credit and I was like, maybe we should really talk about credit. And then I was thinking about credit a lot and I thought, we'll be talking about credit. And then as the world is wont to do, news happened this week, Nora. Big news happened this week. And big scary news happened this week.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about the news that matters less, though it's all kind of connected because it's still the people that are running Canada right now, and then go into what are people calling it? World War III? World War III.
Oh God.
Oh my God. Okay. So yeah, let's just talk quickly about federal politics and where federal politics were this week. A couple of things to note. Where to start? Did you see the federal government has a housing strategy? Finally, a housing strategy. Oh my God. Everyone's going to be able to afford their house. Finally. Did you see this?
Everyone's going to be able to afford their house. No, I didn't see that. I certainly didn't see that announcement. I did see that there was a strategy to stop the financialization of the housing market, which, I mean, are we going back in time? Because I feel like the ship has sailed on that one.
A little bit. Okay, so I think let's first talk about the most obvious, ridiculous plan in this, which is you can now get a 30-year mortgage. 30-year mortgage. You can be paying your mortgage off longer than a mass murderer in Canada is staying in jail.
Oh my God.
And I'm not saying that to say that they should be in jail less. I'm saying that you should be paying less years of your mortgage. Because what does a 30-year mortgage do? It spreads out the interest payments. It forces you to pay more money to the bank. And it will simply allow you to spread out your debt even further. And then they're also allowing you to dip into your RRSPs. And then, which is something we were already able to do, but you can do it up to $60,000, which of course assumes like that you have $60,000 in RRSPs, but not enough money put on a down payment, which is unlikely. This is my kind of favorite little piece, though, about that announcement. Did you know, Sandy, that you have to repay your RRSPs if you do dip into them to make a down payment on a house?
I did know that. Yeah.
Okay. I didn't know that. And it just, it's like, sorry. So you can be saddled then with your mortgage and your RRSP repayments for the first 5 years of your new home owning life. That seems like a recipe for making sure people have nothing but debt.
It's, I mean, that announcement also is so weird because it's like, it's, you know, $60,000. It's like, is the government aware of what's happening with housing across this country? Like not just in Toronto and Vancouver, but like across the country, a $60,000 down payment. I mean, okay, government, like I'm not like it's very like, thank you for allowing us to take out of our RRSPs money that isn't there, that will not help towards getting a house. That's great. Yeah. Thanks so much.
You know, I remember walking into the bank when I first had my kids and they're in like strollers. They're obviously very little. And the bank person was like, oh my God, do you have RRSPs yet for your kids? And I'm like, lady, I spent years fighting RESPs. I'm not buying my kids RESPs, but I'm especially not buying them RESPs when I'm staring down a $22,000 bill for freaking childcare right now. Like I have priorities and it's called today, not 20 years from now. So thanks for this lesson in, I don't know, economics, but no, thank you.
There's got to be ways to give more and more money to banks so that they can borrow that money and make money on your money and not give you anything back. Like, come on, Nora. Priorities.
Right. Yes. Well, you know, and on this question of financialization, as you say, it's too late. It is too late to for sure, to some extent. But it also is something that requires radical change, really, really, really radical change. Back in the era of massive home building expansion in Canada in the post-Second World War period, they actually made a priority of removing profit from home building. And when they removed profit from home building, that meant that people were able to purchase the house based on the cost that it cost to build the house and some measure of how much the land cost. And, you know, because I'm writing this book right now on the corporate control of Canada, do you know how much, Sandy, they were selling houses for in 2024 dollars? Not what they paid in 19...
That's what I was just about to ask.
Yeah.
What they were, oh gosh, was it even in the six figures?
No, it wasn't.
Oh my God. It costs less than six figures. So, okay. Was it 75,000?
No, it was 60. It was 60 to 70. I mean, there was obviously a range, but that is in adjusted for 2024 dollars.
Wow. Wow. That's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, there was an entire infrastructure and system around actually housing Canadians. And we can look at the negative sides of that, which were building a white Christian nation and the genocide that was in full swing at that time and having to populate Canada to give it its white Christian kind of hegemony over the rest of everybody else who was on this land. those are the bad parts of it. The good parts of it, Canada was like, it'd be bad if people didn't have a place to live. And we're so far away from that right now. It's really stunning.
Yeah. I mean, as we discussed last week, you know, there's so much in the ways that the government is just fully not working. And this is a big example of one. And I'm curious to see if there's going to be more in the budget that they'll allude to. But like all of their schemes, all of their plans, none of it seems to acknowledge the pain and the crunch that people are feeling right now. Like the problem isn't, what were people able to take out from the RSP program before? I think it was something like 25,000. The problem isn't 35,000. The problem,
something like that. Yeah.
Whatever amount it was, the problem that people are experiencing isn't, I just need another $30,000 from my RSP. And then everything in my life, when it comes to affording where I live, is going to be just fine. That is not the problem that people are experiencing. And it again sort of speaks to this, the way that the liberal government really wants to target particular voters, but are also really, really far removed from the experience that people are having on the ground. There are people who are renters who, I don't know, maybe would want to vote for a centrist kind of government that doesn't take a lot of stances on everything or whatever the fuck. But it seems as though they have like no, they are paying no attention to that population who desperately needs some help, and more help than just like a renter's bill of rights, which, I mean, thanks, but no thanks. You know, each of the provinces already has some sort of legislation, whether it goes far enough or not, to support tenants. And this Bill of Rights isn't going to do much more changes there. What they need to do is actually change policy and, dare I say, regulate, because that is one of the functions of government. It's not just writing checks and making statements, which is what I think this government thinks that all they think that they're supposed to be doing.
But you know what? You know who's a man of action, Sandy?
Are you about to say Pierre Poilievre?
I'm about to say Pierre Poilievre, because that guy is so in touch with the working man that in his speech last week on the amazingness of the working class, he chose, of all the professions that he could choose, of all the working class professions that he could choose, he said that he trusts the man, the welder, who with his bare hands can forge irons together.
Oh, do they have hands after doing that?
Yeah, it's like, I'm thinking of like all the construction like work that you could do with your bare hands, and how he picked the welder out of the menu of fucking options. I mean, I've never welded, but I know what welding is, but I'm wondering if he doesn't know what welding is.
Man, who wrote the speech? I mean, the funny thing though, Nora, is that won't matter.
Oh, of course not. I mean, it won't matter. You know what? And this is the thing that's really interesting. It matters to an extent. It matters to demonstrate to people that this guy is obviously a hack. But conservative brand is so strong that people will put up with hacks and people who they think are fools or charlatans because they support the conservative brand. And that is actually where the liberals kind of try with their brand. And they certainly have a brand that people understand and that they might support regardless of who's in power. But it doesn't push people like into an always voting liberal bloc. The liberals are always, you know, under attack on the right and the left in terms of like people going to other parties if they are angry with the leader. And so they don't have the same kind of like benefit that the conservatives have. The NDP should have that kind of benefit, but they don't, because they don't know what year it is and what they're doing and why they're here and what is politics.
Oh God, we are doomed.
Yeah.
We're doomed.
You know what? Let's talk about World War III.
this is where I was going. We're doomed for more reasons than Pierre Poilievre being the one man of action in the country. We're also doomed because it really does seem like we are on the precipice of World War III. And I don't know, if you're listening, you might have some of the same anxieties that I had this week as I was watching the news, very, very horrified. There are so many different things to discuss with what has happened this week. And I think the most important thing, of course, is to, you know, because of who we are and the type of commentary that we're trying to provide to our listeners, is to talk about this from a Canadian angle. And I think one of the most important things to recognize is just how much this week I feel like the idea that Canada is a fake country was like fully confirmed.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that all starts with Israel's attack on Iran's embassy in Damascus, and how you may have heard this, you may have not. I mean, it was reported much later than it happened, but it didn't make a lot of news, and the government didn't have much to say about it. But Canada's embassy was damaged in that attack, and I mean, I don't know, like, what would you expect when a country's embassy is damaged in the course of of another country carrying out war efforts on another entity that are already against international law? Like, what would you expect? What would you expect, Nora?
At the very least, I would expect a statement. I would expect Canada to say, guess everybody, what just happened?
At least a statement, something. And that didn't happen, which seems so fucking bizarre because, I mean, God, like, as we have seen during the course of this Israel's fucking genocidal assault, there are a range of statements that the government can make that are things that we would absolutely disagree with, but are at least in keeping in being a fucking country at, like, that exists at all. But to like fully ignore that has happened, and or I assume what they're trying to do is to not call attention to it and hope that nobody notices. I mean, that seems outrageous. Like, even the conservatives, I could not imagine a man of action such as Poilievre, like that government, ignoring this. Like, I would imagine that they would put out some sort of statement about how necessary it is or something, and how Canada, you know, it's a small price to pay, blah, 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 blah. But nothing? Zero? I mean, Melanie Jolie was asked, you know, did you get a heads up from Israel? Did Israel give you a heads up that this would be happening? Because if you haven't seen the reports, the Iran's embassy in Damascus is like very, very close to the Canadian embassy. So it's like likely that if you were going to attack that embassy, you were going to impact Canada's embassy, which has not been in operation since 2012. But the building is still owned by the Canadian government, and they employ people on the ground to take care of it. And Melanie Jolie said, no, they did not provide us with the heads up. And that's all we really have from the Canadian government on this, which is appalling.
Mm-hmm. It's really wild. Like, imagine Russia struck, I don't know, the fucking American embassy. No, that doesn't work. I don't know, the Brazilian embassy, and we got fucking, our embassy got smashed as well in Ukraine at the same time. Canada would call that an act of war. It's been really fascinating to watch the reporting on this happen because I don't know, Sam, if you realize this, but the day that airstrike happened in Damascus was the same day that the World Central Kitchen aid workers were also killed by an Israeli airstrike.
Oh, no, I did not realize that it was on the exact same day. No.
Yeah. So I made a video about this on YouTube. So people, you can check it out if you want to see me being like ranty about it. But when I was looking at, like, just for the dates of these two things happening on the same day, I was like, wait, that doesn't make, like, there's no way that a Canadian aid worker being killed by Israel, former veteran of the Canadian Armed Forces, did a tour of Afghanistan on paper, a fucking hero. And that happening the exact same day that the Canadian embassy was damaged in this airstrike of the Iranian embassy. And I had to like triple check or quadruple check across news reports because there's no news reports that connect the two, not connect as in related, but connect as in they happen on the same fucking day. And when you look for anything about the Canadian embassy, I mean, you know, the Canadian government did make a statement about Jacob Flickinger, the Canadian who was killed in that airstrike, but nothing at all about the embassy until Evan Dyer from CBC starts asking questions. And then Julie refused to say whether or not they were given a heads up until a day later. She then said, no, we were not given the heads up. It truly does put it on display that Canada is not real. You know, Dyer makes the point in his article saying that, you know, yeah, the embassy has been closed, but it's been a base of operations for some things that they know that RCMP have operated there, which is like, whoa, what? What is the RCMP doing in Damascus? That's interesting. Is it not? Like right beside the Iranian embassy? Isn't that like what? What? That seems like a layer of information that goes down very, very deep that Canadians have no fucking idea about and journalists probably don't either. But there's no information because the government does want us to forget about this. And because, you know, if we acknowledge that Israel struck an embassy outside of the bounds of international law and that actually, oops, our windows got blown out as a result and our foundation is now, you know, in a questionable state, then we would have to acknowledge that Iran has been the victim and Canada to some extent as well of Israel. And Sandy, why does that not help as a narrative right now?
Because I don't know, like we will do anything that Israel asks. I don't understand. Like the interesting thing about Dyer's article, which, you know, you should read if you have a chance, is like the final sentences at the end that show how a country could respond because it's about an airstrike that hit and killed members of the French consulate, staff members of the French consulate. And, you know, France like said something about it. Like, you know, France has been allied with the United States and Israel generally when it comes to this issue. But their citizens still come first. Which I think it was supposed to be like the whole point of countries, but I don't know. It's like, it's very, very, very bizarre that Canada is acting in this way. And as there's news coming today, as of today, which is, you know, again, we record on Sunday. So there's news coming as of April 14th that Israel is now asking for Canada to designate Iran's Revolutionary Guard as a terrorist group. And, you know, I bet, you know, Canada is going to do exactly what Israel asks in this case. And now, obviously, you know, I guess we should back up a little bit because even before the 14th, there has, of course, been a response, as there would be, there must be, from Iran as after Israel bombed their embassy in Damascus. And that is what, you know, has many of our anxieties up, as it seems like we're marching towards World War III. And it, I mean, it's like watching the way that has been reported is really quite stunning. It's like, you know, propaganda doesn't work as well in an internet world where people can see what's real and what's not, can see that Israel had taken military steps, military actions, had led an offensive against Iran, and that Iran is responding, even though so many of these reports are like, are reporting it as though it isn't a response. It's very, very like ineffective because people can see what's happening.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so there's a lot of stuff that you've said there that is so important and that I want to try to remember to respond to all of it. The first thing, it will be very interesting to see what Canada does in relation to Iran's Revolutionary Guard. Now, there are people who have been calling, Iranians included, in Canada, who've been calling for a long time for Canada to declare the Revolutionary Guard a terrorist entity. Canada can't do that because they're not a group. They're not a group of terrorists. They're a national army. And you cannot designate a national military entity as a terrorist organization. They're just an enemy military. Like, they're, if they had like proxy groups, which, you know, Canada has no problem naming different proxy groups as terrorists. But if you look at the terrorist list, there's no military bodies are on that list. And Canada is not likely to deem them a terrorist organization unless they really, really, really want to step outside the bounds of what is considered normal in international law, which, I mean, we are through the looking glass on that one. So it will be interesting to see how Canada responds to Israel's call there. I'm sure, like, everybody on Saturday night watching the news from wherever we are getting the news. And actually, I should say, like, it was really weird having this global, huge global event and watching it on Twitter, knowing that Twitter is just like a fraction of what it used to be. And my partner was watching like random YouTube videos of people that he has come to decide is like are people he trusts. So like he's got like military analysts on YouTube doing their own channels. Mm-hmm, and it's just like, okay, you know, I turn on BBC for 5 seconds and the first thing that the person says is like Iran has its own proxies and it uses its proxies to attack Israel and the United States. And so this is a very surprising thing. I was like, okay, that's not very interesting. Click. So anyway, I imagine people had a similar kind of experience on Saturday night with that. But, you know, I think that considering where we are right now in the world, April 14th or 16th, whatever you're listening to this, 2024, we have to keep our eyes on what matters. And since October 7th, what is clear to me is the thing that matters, me and of course a lot of other people, what matters most are the people who are affected most by this, which of course are Palestinians. And the death toll has been revised up again. So the death toll is now at 36,000 people at least. And, you know, I watched Iran's attack and was waiting to hear for information about casualties. I heard, you know, a little girl may have been injured in the south of Israel. But Iran seemed to actually try to not hurt people and actually try to attack military targets. And, you know, we've been so warped around by what Israel's been doing to Palestine and to Gaza, and of course, as well, increasingly in the West Bank, that, you know, we forget that the engagements of war is like, you can attack a military installation. Like, that's that, you know, you might not agree with it. You might condemn it because that's, you're opposed to that nation doing the attacking. That's a fucking, that's a green light location to fucking hit. Actually, it's a military base. And I was looking to see what the casualties were in this. And CNN's headline from tonight, from Sunday night, is this: Iran's attack seemed planned to minimize casualties while maximizing spectacle.
Wow.
And it was like a bit of a relief to be like, oh my God, is that actually what war is supposed to look like? Where it is about spectacle, it is about showing off your might and all this kind of shit, but then you actually are trying to minimize how many people you actually kill?
Well, fuck. I mean, I will say, like, I had a sense of relief when I was watching this happen on the internet through, you know, trying to see all of the news reports, Twitter, which was just so irritating, and just trying to figure out like what was happening after the strikes had happened, and then seeing Iran's a statement that they put out saying that we consider this matter complete at this point. You know, there will be no further anything from us unless Israel retaliates or the U.S. retaliates. At this point, we consider this complete, which seems like an entity trying to respond, because they feel that they have to, while also trying to prevent World War III, which, I mean, we haven't seen that sort of engagement at all from Israel. And it's like, to see that side by side is really quite something. But also, I mean, to all of us who are feeling a sense of like doom about this, we need to be sober and remember the most important thing when it comes to war. Wars don't end because of some sort of the best military offensive that's not going to end anything. And I think, I mean, I'm really still quite nervous. The United States has, Biden has put out a statement saying that they would not join Israel in any sort of offensive against Iran, which, I mean, they kind of already have. They've given them so much resources to go forward with some other offensive if they want to. So there's that. Israel, for their part, has said that they are going to respond when the time is right, whenever whatever the fuck that means. There's been also reports of Biden having conversations with Netanyahu, saying that he needs to see this situation as an actual win for Israel, because while Western media is reporting that not a lot of critical targets were hit, other media is reporting that Iran did hit some of the targets that they wanted to hit. I don't know, you know, fog of war, right? But the idea that the U.S. is trying to get Israel to see this as a win, so as not to encourage further activity, it's like, could we not see that we were going to get to this point way back in October? Like, wasn't that obvious? Everything that the United States has done, that Canada has done, that a lot of countries in the West has done, has supported this move. It was like, Israel can do no wrong. And we've been in that place for a very long time. We've watched tens of thousands of people be slaughtered without stop, a famine now ongoing, the decimation of hospital after hospital, how many children have been killed, and all of these countries, you know, didn't give a shit. We're just fine to support the ongoing military actions that led us to this place. Could you not? Where else would this go? Where else would this go? I just don't know what anybody who were a part of the strategizing on foreign affairs were thinking. Like, you obviously needed to use any fucking power that you had, any leverage that you had, to try to stop us from getting to this point. But here we are right now. And so, you know, like, at this point, that's the fucking situation. That is where we're at. And can we expect that Israel is going to, as Biden says, see this as a win and just fucking stand down? No, I don't think we can.
No, and you know, Israel has demonstrated that it is the irrational actor in all of this. You know, like, we've been so primed to expect irrational actions from a country like Iran that, I mean, I don't know how Canadians who might not be paying attention to this stuff, who will be prone to racist fear mongering or war mongering, would react to the idea that Iran is, you know, in terms of the body count, like, more people have been killed in Gaza and the West Bank in the last 24 hours than were killed apparently in Iran's attack. We don't know the numbers, of course, because who knows what Israel is going to say if there were casualties, but nothing has come out saying that there were significant casualties. And so here we have Israel that needs the West, the rhetoric, the air wars in the West, to understand them as having been under attack by Iran, to now go out and do whatever they're going to do. The only thing saving us in this whole calculus is that Israel is still a small country. I mean, they have a massive military, but they're not going to be able to spread them out too thin and spread themselves out too thin. And, you know, they're still talking about a ground offensive in Rafah. It's like, this is where I turn back to Canada and say, okay, so, like, let's give for a second Trudeau and Jolie the benefit of the doubt. And they are too far into this with the United States to be able to really say no, like, to stand up against the United States. This is where you look at the balance of forces in Canada and say, okay, so what then is there to try and shake things up on the question of war in this country? And if the polls are saying that Canadians don't want to go to war, and if the NDP ever had the fucking guts to actually make these issues the saving grace of the Liberals, like on the question of continuing this war, the NDP will not support the Liberals. And then the Liberals having to face the electorate on those terms, whether or not they actually face the electorate or whether or not they like are too afraid. And so then there's like, you know, negotiations that happen or whatever. But that kind of pressure is actually really important because there is still a democratic will in this country. And if the democratic will and the winds shift and there's actually a vehicle for us to express those opinions, then all of a sudden things become possible that are impossible when it is just Melanie Joly and Justin Trudeau and a bunch of fucking liberal hacks sitting around the table being like, oh my God, we can never stand up to Biden. We can never stand up to Israel. I mean, this is just like where I can't think too hard about the failure of the NDP because it just makes me actually like incandescently angry because that has been from the start one of the very few levers that are actually available to us if the NDP is not a Zionist party. And they say that they're not. And they say, I mean, I'm not sure if they've ever formally said that, but certainly they've been critical of Israel. Except there's no mechanism, there's no lever. There's just the actions in the street of us doing what we can to convince Canadians that this is madness. And those actions are important. That's all we have. And we're doing, I think people are doing the best that they can. And you know, things are starting to tear a little bit in some places. I know I've seen some of that in some of those discussions that have happened within some groups. But it's like, fuck NDP, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you. I like, it is so, like, as you say, we knew where this was going. On October 7th, we knew where this was going. And it just, every day is like another step down the garden path of fucking shit. And all we can hope for is that, like, Israel runs out of fucking stamina or weapons or soldiers, all of things that we know are really going quite strong. And I don't even know, Sandy, if you saw this, but like there was a secret trip to Ottawa this past week by Naftali Bennett.
What? No. I did not see this.
So if people don't know who he is, Naftali Bennett was the prime minister of Israel up until June 2022. And he had a secret meeting in Ottawa that activists discovered the day of and were able to kind of disrupt a little bit.
Well, do we know anything about what it was about? Or like what came out of it, what they were trying to accomplish?
I have not seen anything reported on it. I mean, it happened on Friday. And so, you know, just looking up very quickly, Sean Boynton at Global News is saying that Naftali Bennett is disappointed in Canada's position on Israel's military campaign in Gaza, arguing Israel is being held to a double standard, not shown to others in times of war.
What the
Sandy, do you think that Boynton actually then follows that up to be like, wait a minute, is that true?
I would hope so, because that would be like the basic thing that you should do as a journalist. I don't know. Did he?
No. It goes right into the government has said it supports Israel's right to defend itself while saying a sustainable ceasefire cannot be one-sided. Urged Israel to do more to protect civilians and facilitate the delivery of humanitarian aid. It goes on to Anthony Housefather for some fucking reason. And Bennett is being, this is from an interview from the Westlock, Global's public affairs magazine program. And Bennett criticized Canada's stance on restoring funding to UNRWA.
What?
He's disappointed. He told Mercedes Stevenson, "We expect friends to be with us and not when it's easy, but when it's tough. Do you understand how vital it is that the world supports us in defeating this total evil?" And the article doesn't push back on that either. It's just, it's like the total evil. Fucking there it is. Fact. Israel's fighting, quote unquote, total evil.
Oh my God. It's just so terrible.
This is actually really a disgusting article, and it goes on, and it doesn't actually really get into, it doesn't push back on anything. It just goes into like wire copy stuff about this many people have been killed there. Plus the United Nations is warning, plus the airstrikes. It says Bennett, a self-described right-wing Israeli nationalist who served as prime minister. They have to say self-described because they don't even have the fucking balls to say that the guy is literally a fucking fascist. He has to say he's a fucking fascist. And then they have to put around quotes.
I mean, how are they like still reporting any government repeating the line that Israel has a right to defend themselves in the context of Iran the context of Iran's response. Like, is that just a, is that the thing just for Israel? This country having rights to, for defense, that's just Israel. I mean, I suppose Canada doesn't even have the right to defend themselves since, you know, we willingly took the offensive to our own embassy and didn't do anything about it. But like, how can a journalist honestly like repeat that statement again in an article, given the reality of the situation right now? That seems like,
oh, outrageous. It gets worse. No, it gets worse. Get this. Bennett has added that Israel's done, quote, more than any other country in the history of warfare to reduce collateral damage, unquote, including distributing warnings, blah, blah, blah. He said Israel's also committed to ensuring a peaceful future for Gaza once Hamas has been eliminated. We have to defeat Hamas. Hamas has to be gone. And only then we'll be able to rebuild a new Gaza and hopefully a peaceful Gaza, unquote. Literally, that is, and then there's nothing pushing back. Like, it's just his fucking bullshit in this article and nothing at all pushes back. And then the next subheading is this: Iran, an octopus of terror, in square quotes.
Oh my God. Like, I mean, even just, you know, as a journalist, the fucking death toll of journalists themselves and how astronomical it is compared to any other offensive, like, how could you write something like that? Putting it in quotes, I said, like, who to attribute it to somebody else, but not follow it up with, here are the stats of how outsized Israel's response has been compared to any other recent or in memory fucking offensive in a similar of a similar, like, fucking, what am I trying to say, like, just how outsized it has been. Oh my God.
Well, not to mention, like, literally, if you look at the last weekend that Bennett is in Canada for, which side has been working to reduce casualties? It's not Israel. It's fucking Iran. Sorry, Bennett, you fucking lying asshole. It's really wild. And the story, I mean, it goes on and it just ends with this. Iran now has been enjoying fighting a one-sided war with Israel. We're in a boxing ring and one side is hitting the other and the other is not responding. If they directly attack Israel, clearly Israel will retaliate. And what I've learned is that the Iranian regime is an incompetent and corrupt and a lousy regime. People despise it. They don't like incurring losses and they have a lot to lose. And that is the end of the article. Total fucking PR for the fucking, for a warmongering genocidal regime, pure PR in a national fucking news agency in Canada.
So, so bizarre. There's also, like, if you go to the CBC news page, there is an article that talks about, well, the headline is that Israel's ambassador to Canada still hopes for a diplomatic solution to the conflict, which it's like, it's so weird. Why would that be in the headline of any article? Like, it is so clear that that is not what Israel is hoping for. I mean, they're talking about a ground offensive in Rafah almost immediately after what happened. With respect to Iran's response, there was a call to get the G7 together to make sure that there was some sort of statement that was put out that that consolidated the G7 in supporting Israel, and they did that. They did that immediately. That statement has come out as of today. The G7 said that they unequivocally condemn, in the strongest terms, the direct and unprecedented attack against Israel by Iran.
Okay.
Yep, and that they will strengthen their cooperation to end the crisis in Gaza. And get this, Nora, including by continuing to work towards an immediate and sustainable ceasefire. Imagine if the G7 had said that fucking months ago, and not in the context of like an unequivocal support for Israel, but in the context of unequivocal support for like human fucking lives.
But they can't.
They express their full solidarity and support to Israel and its people and reaffirm their commitment towards its security and stand ready to take further measures now and in response to further destabilizing initiatives.
They can't, though. They can't, because this is all, this is war. And as much as it's, I mean, I don't like at all the cheerleading, it seems like some people have to like imagine living through World War III, although I kind of get it, because when we're so disconnected from, you know, reality, the way that the internet has made it disconnected, I don't begrudge people's kind of bizarre reactions to all of this, to be honest. But, you know, one more article from Evan Dyer at CBC, I think just says so much. That the countries, this is his tweet, it says that the countries that lost citizens in aid convoy attack reject Israel Defense Forces report, right? Because the IDF said that it wasn't intentional or whatever. Australia, Poland, the UK, US all indicate that they are not satisfied, while Canada remains mute. So even when they are killing a Canadian citizen, and even when our allies, including the United States, are saying, this report is not good enough, Canada still can't say this report is not good enough. We're so, so wrapped up in this fucking war that we can't say that.
I just like I'm just so stunned by how badly we are even pretending to be a country. Like, and it, as you had mentioned earlier on this, in this episode, you know, that's not just the fault of the liberals. It's also the fault of the opposition for failing to put the pressure where it needs to be put in order to force the government's hand on this stuff. Like, all of the opposition parties are also a constituent of government, of making what this country is apparently supposed to be. And it's just, it's like, it's so outrageous. But all's this to say, like, for all of us who are like sitting here kind of like, what the fuck? I mean, We have a duty here too, in this, and that is to force these fucking people who are not doing anything to act in the way that they have to act. Like, our response as people on the ground needs to be strong. We need to make sure that our politicians know that we know that, look, there is no military strategy on this that is going to resolve the situation. It is obviously, as with any other war in history, going to be resolved diplomatically. And that means putting pressure on Israel to stop escalating this fucking situation, which means they cannot continue to provide unequivocal support. That's just fucking obvious. And if the liberals aren't going to do that on their own, if they're going to try to like walk away from any sort of statement that they should be making when things are wrong, then you have to force the opposition parties to force their hand. And that's where we are. And that's our responsibility.